Minnesota 11, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hello, everyone. Before we get started today, I want to thank all of our sponsors, CME Group, Top Step Trader, and Trading Technologies. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. Now, without further ado, let's dial in and get Ira on the line. Ira, welcome back to the show.
Oh, Anthony, great to be with you. It's been a too long a hiatus, but let's get down to business.
Yeah, let's get down to business. I mean, last week we had the long-awaited June FOMC meeting, and then this morning, right out of the gates, before we're getting ready to record today, we get some comments from Dudley. So I want to begin with Dudley's comments today, because it was stirring some conversations up amongst traders this morning on Twitter, and Dudley had said that the flattening of the yield curve is not a negative signal for the U.S. economy, and the flattening of the yield curve is just a reflection of global financial markets. What do you think about what Dudley said today?
Well, Dudley makes a point that Santelli and I talked about when I was on a couple weeks ago, and we talked about it off camera, but Santelli actually brought it up in a conversation with Steve Leisman the other day, which is you can't have it both ways.
Yep.
And Rick was admonishing me. He says, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell me that the Fed signaling mechanism is broken and then putting all this credence into the 210 as to its flattening. And I agree and disagree with it. And what Dudley's telling you, he wants it too. He wants his cake and eat it too. Oh, forget the 210 as a signaling mechanism, because that's what we're talking about. It's flattening means nothing, because he's really rehashing Bernanke's comments of, you know, in 2006 and 2007, in that interest rates were, the long end was the curve was flattening. Why? Because there was a surplus of global savings, especially out of Asia, that were putting a bid into U.S. Treasuries as the money was seeking for places to go. Well, you know what? That proved to be wrong, by the way. Bernanke won a minute, but that proved to be wrong. And Dudley's following the same task or the same reasoning. And it's nothing that you and I haven't really talked about long before he started it, and even Janet Yellen started talking about it, which is, hey, the foreign central banks, meaning the ECB and the BOJ and the Bank of England and the Swiss National Bank, with all their buying and putting liquidity in the system on a relative basis, it forces global investors to seek higher yields. So they're going to U.S. Treasuries, because certainly U.S. Treasuries, they yield more than German bonds, they yield more than French, they yield certainly more than Japanese bonds, so that it puts a bid to it. Do we know that for a fact? No. No, we build that assumption into a certain trading styles that we'll take, and until disproven, yeah, it's right. But Dudley wants to try to explain away why U.S. yields on the long end won't rise, because their models tell them that it has to, that they should rise, because we're coming into inflationary expectations, and even with interest rates, you know, the Fed raised them what, to 1.25? Well, they're still below the inflation rate, and whether you use the CPI, the PCE, or any other thing that you want to measure. So the real yields in the U.S. on the short end are certainly negative, real yields I'm talking about. And that should actually push the longer end higher, until it really shows that the Fed is serious about this and getting to real yields of a positive venue. As I've always said, I will turn bearish on gold when real yields go higher in the United States. That'll make me a short-term bear on gold. But we're not anything close to that. And Dudley doesn't have an answer for it either. They're models. He's trying to protect their models because their models say that, hey, we're at full employment, therefore wage inflation has to rise. And if wage inflation rises, inflation's going to rise and we have to be more aggressive. But right now their models are being called into question, and they're really trying to defend the indefensible because they've been wrong for so long.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Now, we're going to talk about the yield curves, the 210 and actually the 530 in just a moment here, but I want to piggyback off of what you commented on inflation. I mean, in the post-meeting statement, the FOMC stated that the labor market, it's continued to strengthen, and they said that inflation would stabilize around its 2% objective. Now, CPI for May came out last week, and year-over-year increase of 1.73%. This was the second straight sub 2% rise, right? So core PCE, we've talked about this. It's the Fed's favorite measure of consumer inflation. It's not been above 2% since May 2012. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, again, you know, they have their measure. Others have their measures. And that's right. And it is interesting because I promise you, if it gets above 2% and the economy is slowing, what you're going to hear from the Fed is a stochastic-based argument, because they do this all. They do the same thing with unemployment, is that then they go into a thing, well, we're going to smooth it over time, okay? So the fact that you cite that inflation has been under their 2% level for, what are we talking about, 6-7 years? They'll say, okay, we can let it run a little hot. We've heard that argument from before. So that will get interesting. First of all, these measures are ridiculous. Who said that 2% inflation? When did this come to be an accepted norm? Because that's always a vacillating number, and sometimes you have good inflation, sometimes you have bad inflation. Good inflation is that the economy revs up a little bit. You are getting some pressure, and it's making people make decisions about productivity and things like that. Those are fairly good measures. The Fed's measure of good inflation, though, this 2% came into being because with the huge amount of debt that overhangs the entire global financial system, they need inflation. They need inflation because without inflation, you'll have Japan, which nobody wants, of the last 30 years, or not 30 years, 25 years for sure, in which deflation was holding back all types of things and was causing havoc in the Japanese financial system, because people levered up, they taken on a lot of debt. When you owe debt and prices aren't rising, the debt load becomes that much more significant. So that's what this all refers to. And to me, they define it. It's their game. It's their umpire. It's their bat and ball, and it's their field. So you know what? We have to live with it, and we try to dance around it. But even noted economists like Rogoff have said, when trying to relieve the debt load, that the Fed should actually let inflation run 5-6%, because that would do a lot to alleviate the huge amount of debt that overhangs the economy. It's a nebulous term, but we're stuck with it. And the fact that Dudley's speaking to it, he's got nothing else to say. But again, I come back to this. It all fits, and they can explain their models. But their models, of course, aren't working, because at 4.3% inflation, I'm sorry, at unemployment, they're expecting wage inflation. But we know globally wage inflation is not taking hold. And that's, that's an argument on itself that they just cannot come to terms with. But even somebody who I not always agree with, Larry Summers, in a Washington Post and Financial Times op-ed piece on Friday, took the Fed to task for relying on the NARU, which is the concept of full employment and wage inflation, as an outdated and outmoded measure. So when somebody of that stature attacks the Fed, they what they do is they circle the wagons and then try to defend that which they've relied upon. And that's the world in which we live in.
Yes, it is. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about these 210 yield curve that I watch very closely. And you and I have had this conversation before. It's something that I, over the years, have learned that if it gets flat, then that would be potentially bearish for the U.S. economy. We've talked about, you know, a lot of the things that's going on within the Fed, and we've talked about how the yield curve has reacted. It got down to 78 basis points, and you know, I read your blog all the time, and you said that 73 basis points is key support. So we hit 78, we've come off to up to 82 now. Talk to us about why that support level is important to you, and what do you think happens if it's broken? Like, what does it mean?
Okay. So, this is all part of the argument we had. And the 73, as you cite, 73.8, I've actually blogged about for probably about four or five years, and yep. It's been tested. And you and I know that when we watch charts, when something continually gets tested, it's only a matter of time before it gives way. So now we're down here again. This is the third time down here over the last 4 or 5 years. In 2016, it held almost to the tick that we had talked about. And I remember being out with you. We talked about 74.8. It was exactly where it held at. Now, if it goes through there, it's usually a signal that things are starting to slow down and people are leery about taking on risk, you know, of longer duration, and they start parking money into the Treasury market. Is this time different? Well, I don't know. We do have, every time the Fed, you know, the major discussion right now is shrinking the balance sheet. Well, you know, there's two ways you can shrink the balance sheet. You can stop reinvesting things that reach their expiration, which is what the Fed is talking about, or you can actually become an active seller. The Fed can enter the market and start selling their assets that they've purchased in what Peter Buchvar has really nicely called a quantitative tightening, because when they were busy buying, we're calling it quantitative easing, and now we're on a quantitative tightening. We don't know the impact that it's going to have, because really, if the Fed stops doing this, the curve ought to, this is what should happen. The curve should steepen, because you're removing a buyer from the long end of the market, or, you know, a longer duration, regardless. And once the market really senses that the Fed, because nobody has stated a time, this is what they would like to do, and they're going to wait for whatever criteria they deem, because again, it's their ball game. They've taken this on by themselves. So the curve should steepen, because when people know that the biggest buyer in the market is going to be removed and may actually become a seller, they'll push bond prices down, yields higher, because hey, they're going to challenge them. That's what markets do. And that's what should be taking place here, but it's not. And it may be that the market is saying, hey, the Fed, you're raising rates and you're shrinking the balance sheet, which is reducing liquidity in the system and making the availability of liquidity more expensive. And we think you're doing this at the wrong time. And this is the great quandary that the markets exist in right now. And that all people who are investors have to monitor and go, this is the quandary. Is the Fed moving too late? Have they waited too long? And are we going into a, you know, cyclical, or, you know, there's economic cycles. We've been in a long-term growth cycle, not a robust one, but a continual growth cycle, one of the longest in history. So they're saying, well, you're starting to raise now and you're starting to remove liquidity. You're too late to the party. And we think you're going to cause a recession. And if it breaks through that level, That's what the market is saying. Hey, you've waited too long, and we're looking for negative things, because the Fed believes fiercely that all their actions should lead to a steepening curve. I mean, they're out there talking, but we have to raise more because we have to push the long end of the curve higher, and that'll get people to think that the curve will go higher, because that's what their models say. But it's not happening. So I am watching this very carefully. I don't know, because of the Fed's breaking the market mechanisms, letting the market actually be the arbiter of value, it's very hard to determine. And that's what everybody is struggling with. But I, you know, that 210 curve for me has never failed. You know, a lot of people say, oh, the stock market's a bad indicator of recessions, because it's, you know, if you look at stock valuations at any time, as they famously like to quip, is that the stock market predicted, you know, 10 of the last 5 recessions because market actions. But that's not true about the 210 curve. The 210 curve, I would say, has 100% success. The problem is, from a trader standpoint, is how to time it. Because you can see the last time we had a massive flattening of the curve was 2007. We had an inversion. Well, the Fed was busy raising rates by a quarter of a basis point, which, who came up with a quarter of a basis point rate rise is ridiculous anyway, but that's my own thought. The long end was, as Bernanke said, because of the glove Asian savings, pushed the curve into an inversion, and we know what followed. It took 6 to 8 months, but it did come. So, you know, again, I've been watching these curves for a long, long time. I listen to people talk about them now who have no more knowledge of them than 5 years of knowledge, and I kind of laugh them when they're out there talking. This stuff is tried and true on yield curves. Is this time different? Well, we're going to find out, because the only way it's going to be different is because, of course, the way the central banks have played with the markets and manipulated the markets. So we'll see. But I'm watching, and again, I need weekly and, of course, monthly closes, which need much more powerful signals than any day signal. So I just urge caution until we really get a more signal of a longer-term nature.
Yep. And, you know, for me watching this, the yield curves over the years, I've learned that equities are always lagging. I mean, they're always lagging the bond market. The bond market is going to signal something. And then, you know, as an S&P trader over the years, you want it to happen now, but it just doesn't. And it drives you nuts. But then over time, it ends up, like you had said, the 210 yield curve, by it getting really flat, I think that it will have an effect on equities. And we just haven't seen that yet. But you noticed something technically the other day in NASDAQ in one of your posts. I want you to comment on that.
Yeah, we saw a significant signal, which is a very rare signal. And that was it's already 10 days ago that I posted that. There was a Sunday post after the NASDAQ 100 had made all-time highs for that week in question, and closed below, the weekly close was below the previous week's close. And that's a very rare signal, because all-time highs are only made once, right? Once in any trading cycle. So that was significant. We got actual follow through on that last week. And to me, it is a major warning sign. Now, of course, the markets are up this morning, but, you know, as I said on a following blog after that, on Friday, I was watching to see if the DAX, if the European, the German index, DAX futures, because they looked like they were going to put in a similar signal to NASDAQ, but they didn't. The DAX came and rallied on Friday to save itself, as we would say. Now, today, the DAX is 1% higher, so screaming. And I said, you know what? This would make me be long other equity markets, and I particularly like the DAX because, you know, we got negative 2-year yields in Germany this morning. We don't guess at these things. We know these things are negative 65 basis points. They have a budget surplus. They have a current account surplus. You know, Germany is and they have an undervalued currency because they belong to the euro. So that's, you know, to me, a play that I'm looking for, and I cited, I used that reversal number, which came in at 126.33.5 on the DAX, to actually buy them there. And, you know, I have to tell you, they're up sizably this morning. So to see that through, again, you know, there are a lot of mixed signals out there, but I take that NASDAQ signal and the NASDAQ 100 as a very important signal going forward here.
Okay. A couple of things I just want to make sure everyone understands why I watch the 210 yield curve. I actually watch the 530 as well, because you put me onto that. And I really watch it, even though I trade a strategy for S&P and other markets, I watch it to understand what the big picture is. Is the big picture superseding my strategy at the moment? And I think what I get from you today, Ira, is that if we break 73 basis points in the 210 yield curve, We then want to see if that steepening or flattening from that point, well, we'd be looking for more flattening, is going to start affecting equities. And then with a technical breakdown like we saw on NASDAQ, and maybe I have a reason to be short S&P, who knows if that happens, right? It seems like every time I do get one, I get a chance to get a few off, and then it goes right back to my price, or it's a loser. But that is something to where we might see some real follow-through to the downside, because that yield curve could be saying to us that we're entering a recession. Is that accurate?
Yes, yes. And we will watch it, because once it gets through there, it should really, it will go technically. Now, you know, the Fed, we'll watch the Fed throughout this, because the Fed wants the curve to steepen. They know what this flattening yield curve is, which is why when you started the program and you talked about Dudley today, he can't dismiss it offhand. You know, they're just worried. They're worried that it'll upset their models, which have proved so flawed to begin with. You know, this whole what they call neighbor, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. It is a totally domestic-based model, because, you know, one thing, they talk models in general terms, but they don't tell us what their assumptions are. Because all models have assumptions built into them. That's the way they work, based on, you know, probabilities and based on their research. So I think that is so flawed, because when Nehru was acceptable discussion, that's going back when I was in graduate school, same with the Phillips curve back in the mid-70s, much has changed in the world. Capital flows around the world willy-nilly. So when capital flows, the impact on labor is dynamic. It's a dynamic relationship, because if I can move businesses to where there's cheaper wage rates, and because there's free flow of capital and I'm not worried about getting my money out, all the model changes dramatically, and it's not imposed, and that's why it's flawed. It's terribly flawed, and that's what Dudley was trying to head off this morning. They're worried about it because they've put so much stake into it, but we'll see. You know what? I vote with markets. When markets are allowed to work, they will send us, you know, much better signals. The collective wisdom of those who are moving money are far better than the Fed, who have their long-held presumptions about the way things work. That's what I'm watching. That will be very important. And, you know, I'm wondering, it's because if the curve starts to flatten, will the Fed start, rather than just letting things expire and not repurchasing, will the Fed become an active seller of some of their holdings in an effort to steepen the curve? That's going to be the yin and yang here.
That's a great point.
That will be very interesting, and we're going to have to watch that very closely.
And see, I go back to the flattening of the yield curves, another reason why I watch them. We know that this market has been led higher by, everyone calls them, the FANGs. I mean, that term kind of annoys me, but yeah, it is, the market is being led higher by a handful of technology names. We know that. But I've learned over the years that, you know, if you don't have full participation on highs or on lows, typically divergence will continue in trend only for so long. And I think the flattening of the yield curves, which becomes very interesting to me, is the financials. This is not good for banks. So at some point, a major aspect of the S&P 500 is being really affected by these yield curves. Am I wrong, Ira?
Oh, Anthony, you bring up a great point. That's 100% right. And that's when these people talk about them. Oh, this will hurt the bank. Oh, this will help the banks out. But meanwhile, the banks have held in here, even with the flattening curves, because they're not right now. With the money held, see, and this is a big difference, because usually when banks were holders of treasuries to a large extent, this would have a far greater impact. But the banks really aren't holding treasuries. You know, some would say because of Dodd-Frank. I would say more likely because of the impact of the Fed. The FOMC, you know, has bought $3.5 trillion. Let me say it again, $3.5 trillion that they hold on their balance sheet, and then you add in what the ECB has bought when they hold on their balance sheet, and the BOJ. So there's a lot of that paper taken out of the market. So the lending institutions are actually forced into more short-term lending. So this may be where, you know, between them being much more involved in the overnight repo and other types of short-term markets, the banks may actually be doing better because they're not holding so many treasuries, and their earnings are actually going up because they've been pushed out of the treasury market because of central bank intervention. So, you know, they're, again, you know, these analysts come out and they all talk about, like, you know, well, this is the way we see it. This is the way it has to be. But you know what? Markets are dynamic and they're adjusting. And to say that a flattening yield curve is bad for banks, it's only bad for banks if lending is slowing down. But if I'm in the short end of the curve and the curve short end is rising, I'm actually making more money. And I think that's why the banks have held up better here than conventional wisdom would hold.
Yeah, well, thanks for explaining that to me, Ira. I didn't quite understand that, and I really appreciate your insight as well. Before I let you go, one thing I want to talk about. We talked about the 210 yield curve. This morning, the 530 yield curve, you've been telling me to keep an eye on the 100 to 101 basis points area. Talk to me about why this is important.
Well, you know, the thing is, and I know we've talked about it, so we'll go back. The 210 is what I call the investor's curve, you know, much more staid insurance companies, pension funds are heavily involved in that 10 because the 10 is a much more of an international barometer. You know, most countries don't have a robust 30-year market. The U.S. does because that's where we've issued debt and it's been the way we've tied up our mortgage market. So it's fairly robust and you have a lot of speculative interest there. Now, early in the year, we had the 530 actually steepening while the 210 was kind of going sideways to a little flattening, which was interesting. But now both curves are flattening together. In fact, the 530 is flattening more. As we sit here this morning, we are making three-year lows down at on the 5 to 10 differential is 101.34 right now. The actual low of the last 3 years, it was made on February 9th of 2015, and that was 100.96. So as you can see, we're in spitting distance, as I would say, of that number. And if we break below 100, it will show a combination, especially where the Fed is less involved, because the Fed's balance sheet doesn't have, while it has mortgage-backed assets, it doesn't have as much 30 longer duration past 7 to 10 years. So with this flattening, the market is speaking loud and clear that, hey, and it says that Dudley's wrong right now because the longer end is being pushed down and there's not as much central bank intervention there. So I'm really on top of this. And as we're talking, the five-year futures, future is down 4.5 ticks, and the 30-year is actually up
3
ticks.
So, exactly.
Yeah. So you're getting a sizable move here this morning. It's really something to pay attention to. I love this. When I'm really in a speculative trading mode, I love to trade this. Right now, you know, I'm waiting to see the way more of this plays out, so I'm really not involved in it other than, you know, it's just one of those keys to me watching this. And, you know what? And again, you know, we don't know what's going on in Europe. You know, a lot of people think that Draghi's going to announce a tapering, which, you know, will have more of a flattening. I think that's a pipe dream on people's parts. You know, the ECB is now only, and I say that tongue in cheek, buying 60 billion euros a month in assets. And they're not tapering in any way, shape or form because He has a mission, but that'll be another radio. That'll be another hit that we do, and really, you know, taking apart Europe again and where they're at. So we'll hold that one out.
Ira, you're the man. Thank you so much for your insight today. I really appreciate it. It's always an education speaking to you, my friend. Thank you so much,
Anthony. Thank you very much. And you know, I think we've done pretty well. You know, last time we advised your listeners to buy cattle at that time because of the Chinese and grains. And I think, you know, both, you know, cattle immediately put on a 20% rally. So, yeah, sometimes you have to blow your own horn. I know I'm not, and I'll also criticize myself when we get it wrong. So let's see what happens here.
No, absolutely, Ira. You're the best for coming on Futures Radio Show again today. Thank you so much, and I look forward to having more conversations with you about all of these topics because, let's face it, Ira, it's just going to continue to be interesting, isn't it? It's not going to go away.
You know what? You know what, Ann? As everybody who listens to the show, markets are dynamic, and we respect and trade that dynamicism. And anybody who thinks that they're static and are selling low vol or in for going to be in for a major surprise.
I think so, too. All right, Ira. Talk to you soon.
All right, Ann. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.